Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's a show for people searching for perfection. Seed conservator Amy Goldman longs for the perfect tomato. In her quest, she has grown, eaten, and cooked some 1,000 heirlooms. She tells all in her book, The Heirloom Tomato from Garden to Table. Food writer David Leet went after the perfect Toll House cookie and had to become Sherlock Holmes, as there was, believe it or not, a long-lost secret trick. Well, to keep family harmony, a Manhattan mom ends up with apartment chickens. In Seattle, it's an idyllic little backyard farm complete with blackberry ice cream from the family goats. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we were recently in Atlantic City, New Jersey, eating at a great bakery called Formica Brothers, which looks like it should be pronounced Formica, but in fact it's Formica. They probably make one of the best sub loaves. Is that the right, Michael? Am I explaining that correct? The long yard of bread that you slice open and then put cold cuts on.
The submarine bread.
But the bread, not
submarine
rice.
Bread. But in fact, Jane is right. Sub loaf is correct. You know, Jane and I always assumed that the submarine sandwich was named after the submarine service in World War II. There's that kind of
because it's long and round.
It looks like a sub.
Yeah.
In fact, we were told at Formica Brothers Bakery that it was actually named after the fact that they made long loaves, you know, like long, long loaves for tearing at or slicing. And then they made smaller loaves, sub-sized loaves. In other words, sub being smaller. And that's how, according to this guy, the sub got its name.
Etymology with the Sterns.
Yes,
I love
it's like a demi-baguette.
A demi-baguette, exactly. Wordplay aside, these loaves are perfect. And we know they're perfect, and you probably know they're perfect if you've ever eaten across the street at the White House Sub Shop, which is probably the country's foremost purveyor of sub sandwiches. The White House gets its bread delivered from Formica Brothers 6 to 7 times a day, one reason the sandwiches are so good.
But, you know, I think we got to explain, for those who may not know what we're talking about, the art of the submarine sandwich, what makes a great sub sandwich.
Okay, first of all, it is the bread. The bread in a sub sandwich has to be significant bread and sturdy enough to hold the ingredients, but also the kind of bread that has a certain modesty about its flavor, that is willing to sort of play second fiddle to the ingredients. And, of course, the classic cold-cut sub, as made at the White House on Formica Brothers bread, contains cottagino, capicola, Genoa salami, provolone, lettuce, tomatoes, onions, hot peppers, and oil. I mean, that's the basic thing. And when you watch them make it, you do understand something else that makes a great sub, and that is they don't just put all these things in a flat pile. They kind of fold them over and curve the cold cuts in such a way that they're dozens of interstices between the layers, and that's where it's sort of the oil and the pepper flavor seeps in. So it's a very juicy pile of meat as opposed to a dense one.
It is a high art. I've always believed a great submarine sandwich. Now, is the consistency of the bread sort of the consistency of It's not a baguette, right? It's got to be softer than that, but it's not
it's
a
softer,
hamburger roll
right.
either.
It's not a crusty loaf by
It's
got
to be chewy and sort of muscular enough to absorb, you know, they sprinkle a lot of oil on it, for example. So it can't be the kind of bread that's going to dissolve.
Right.
And the bakers are characters, can I use that word? We tried to sort of ask them about their baking techniques and the bread, and the dialogue went something like this. Jane and Michael say, "And when does the bread go in the oven?" And the baker at Formica said, "When it wants to go in the oven." You know, and so it was kind of like these Zen riddles that we kept getting.
Well, he was explaining to us that bread is a living thing. It's organic. I remember he said, you know, you have to touch it and connect with it. And, you know, even though they make thousands and thousands of loaves a day, you really get the sense that every one of these is babied by the people that make it. You know, this place opened in 1919. And in fact, they had a coal-fired oven that started up in 1927 and stayed hot until 1990, when it was replaced with a new one. And I remember Frank Formica said to us, he said, "If I go to hell for any reason, it's going to be for closing down that oven that people in Atlantic City love so much."
You too. Thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can listen to the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. I've always wondered why some chilies are hotter than others. I mean, the same kind of chili, like jalapenos. In nature, supposedly, there is a reason for everything. Well, much was explained in a piece in the New York Times. It was about a recent chili study. The study was done at the University of Washington, and they found that one chili is hotter than another for protection. Chilies develop heat to protect themselves from marauding bacteria and funguses that could kill off the plant. The scientists found that chilies grown in a hot, humid environment were hot to super hot. Nasty microbes love all that heat and humidity. Identical plants grown in dry conditions produce chilies with barely any heat. Those microbes don't flourish where it's dry. So we're talking basic evolution here. Your environment gets dangerous and you arm yourself against it. Think about that the next time you dip a chip into the salsa. Now you can read about the study in the August 12, 2008 issue of the New York Times. The chocolate chip cookie. The essential American sweet, yearned for by expats across the globe, dreamt about by every kid trapped in fifth period study hall. Well, according to food writer David Leet, a man who ponders such things, no one has surpassed the cookie recipe of Ruth Wakefield. David says her Toll House cookie formula is the gold standard. Except there is a hitch. David did a piece in the New York Times called Perfection? Hint. It's warm and has a secret. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn.
So the perfect Toll House chocolate chip cookie, what's the problem?
Well, there are a couple of problems. The recipe was developed in the 30s. And what we discovered, speaking to Shirley Corher, is that the flours, they believe, were different back then. And we've not adapted it. We've just continued using the same recipe. And people often talk about the Toll House cookie spreading a bit, being a bit too crispy, and just not really holding up. And so I wanted to find out what was really behind it and how could we really best that.
Now, Shirley Currier is a food scientist.
Yes, she is.
So what did you discover?
Well, we discovered a couple of things, that actually there are a lot of things that the home baker can do to actually improve even really any chocolate chip cookie recipe. The major thing we discovered by speaking to Maury Rubin, who is the owner and the baker at City Bakery in New York City, is that he rests his dough. once he makes it, he puts it in the refrigerator, and he rests it for 36 hours.
That's a long rest.
It's a very long rest. And then I spoke to other bakers, and I found out that Jacques Torres rests his dough sometimes up to 5 days, depending upon when he's going to be doling out the dough.
Uh-huh.
And what Shirley told me, and I didn't believe it, really, was that by resting it, the liquid, which mostly is the egg, starts to hydrate the flours, and it does something. And she said it makes it a little bit more firmer, the dough is a little bit drier, and it will affect the cookie. So I went out very dutifully and took chocolate chip cookies, and I used the Toll House recipe. I did the original version and baked it right off, half of it, and I let half sit overnight. And those that sat overnight just had a firmer texture and just seemed like a better-tasting cookie, just very slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that intrigued me. And then so I tried it again, doing it 12 hours, 24 hours, and 36 hours, which were the recommended times from different bakers. The 36-hour cookie was so much better than the one that just went popping in the oven. So that was one thing we discovered. Then another thing we discovered is that warm rules. No matter what, a warm cookie rules. And Murray Rubin said a great thing. He said, even a warm, ordinary cookie can best one of mine right out of the oven, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Huh.
And so, you know, you want to eat your cookies warm, although some people really are absolutely firm believers in having a room temperature cookie. I'm not. I like it gooey and I like it soft. So that's another thing we found out. And then one of the other things we found out is the type of chocolate. What happened when Ruth Wakefield made her cookies was that when she broke up chocolate and dropped it in the batter, there's another theory saying that a bar of chocolate jittered off a shelf when she was mixing up some dough and then fell into the batter. And then she went, okay, what the hell, I'll make the cookies.
Right, sure.
And then it was born. That chocolate, she discovered, didn't melt. It melted, but it didn't ooze. It stayed formed when it cooled. Well, what I discovered through Jacques Torres is he and some other bakers use couverture chocolate, which is what you use to cover truffles or you use in making fine chocolate.
Uh-huh.
And it really melts exquisitely. So what happens is instead of these hard chunks that you get once it cools down, they melt into strata throughout the cookie. So you get these layers of chocolate and layers of cookie and layers of chocolate and layers of cookie. And it gives it's a better chocolate, and it gives it sort of this wonderful texture when you're eating it and this wonderful flavor. And also resting gives much more toffee flavor, much more brown sugar flavor, much more Panuche flavor. All these different flavors come out when you rest it. And then the last little bit we found out, actually none of them mentioned this, and it came from Dory Greenspan. And when she was working with Pierre Hermé.
Yeah, the baker. She's a regular on the show, yeah.
Exactly. And she wrote a book with Pierre Hermé, who's a French baker. And she learned from him the importance of salt in sweet baked goods. And so we put a sprinkling of sea salt on top based upon one of her recipes. And so putting all of that together, we kind of created this communal cookie. And I have to say they are outstanding. And the reaction in the cyber world has been amazing. It's all over the place, from King Arthur Flour to the New York Public Library to eGullet to everywhere. People have been making these cookies and going wild.
Well, David, and they will go on the Splendid Table site as well. David, thank you.
You're welcome, then.
Food writer David Leet is creator of the award-winning website Leet's Culinaria. His cookie recipe appeared in the July 9th, 2008 issue of the New York Times. And as promised, David shared that final recipe for chocolate chip cookies. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the queen of heirloom tomatoes and at home with livestock. Chickens in a New York apartment and a whole peaceable kingdom in a Seattle backyard. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Amy Goldman is a gardener with a mission, and she doesn't fool around with any small ideas. She wants to save America's agricultural diversity, and she has a delicious way of doing it. Amy is a seed conservator, growing out and stabilizing often ignored food seeds. Now, she's the chair of the board of the Seed Saver Exchange, and she's testified before Congress on biodiversity. Part of her mission is saving the heirloom tomato, which, of course, has the side benefit of possibly stumbling on the perfect one. In 35 years, Amy's grown, tasted, and cooked some 1,000 varieties. A large number of them are in her latest book, which I have to say is stunningly photographed. It's called The Heirloom Tomato, From Garden to Table. Amy, welcome.
Lynn, I'm delighted to be with you.
You know, that word is all over the place, heirloom. What does this actually mean?
There are different definitions out there, but let me tell you how I define heirloom. An heirloom tomato is a tomato of value that breeds true, you know, produces offspring like the parents, and thus can be handed down to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that with a modern F1 hybrid. They don't breed true. They don't produce offspring like their parents, and thus you can't save the seed. And, you know, when you can't save the seed, that variety becomes extinct in one generation.
Mm-hmm.
The heirloom tomato, Lynn, is the people's tomato. It's of, by, and for the people. It was developed by generations of farmers, gardeners, mostly amateurs, and designed to be homegrown. I mean, most heirloom tomatoes have an indeterminate plant habit. That means the plants grow large, they need to be staked,
mm-hmm.
But that plant habit is associated with higher fruit quality, and that's one of the factors that give heirlooms their indescribably delicious flavor.
There is a tomato in the book that I had to ask you about because, first of all, there are 16 different tomatoes in this book that share the same name, which is Mortgage Lifter. But the first one on the list is the one with the name that I just adore, Radiator Charlie's Mortgage Lifter.
I know. So, I'm in love with the name.
What's the story behind the Mortgage Lifter and Radiator Charlie?
Well, the term mortgage lifter is a generic term that refers to a set of big old tomatoes, characteristically pink, from central Appalachia. But the term mortgage lifter itself refers to commodities in general that generate extra income for farmers,
mm-hmm.
such as hogs, corn, and beans. Now, Radiator Charlie was a radiator repairman who lived in West Virginia in the 1930s and 40s, was quite an amazing person. He reportedly flew small airplanes, delivered airmail, invented a garden tiller, and all without a formal education. But he's best known for developing a tomato by crossing four heirloom pink beefsteaks and selling the plants for $1 a pop so that he could pay off his $6,000 mortgage, thus Radiator Charlie's Mortgage Lifter. And it tastes as good as it sounds. You know, eating a thick, juicy Mortgage Lifter slab marbled with white like fat is like having a last steak supper before you die and go to tomato heaven.
So, Amy, to your mind, and I know this is like asking you to pick your favorite child, but to your mind, which of all of these tomatoes has maybe the best story to tell?
Very hard to pick, Lynn, but I think one of the most fun tomatoes is the Ricea tomat. It's also known as the traveler, voyager, pocketbook, or handbag tomato. It's like a tomato gone haywire, or what I say, hemorrhoidal in the book. It looks like a bunch of small red tomatoes stuck together. And the lobes can be easily removed so that, you know, if you're traveling, you can just take a piece at a time and save the rest for later. It's a very eccentric and fun tomato. I also love the Nebraska wedding. It's the ultimate love apple. In Nebraska, seeds are reportedly still given to a bride as part of her trousseau. But the seed originated in Minnesota, according to Dorothy Beiswanger, seed saver extraordinaire of Crookston, Minnesota,
uh-huh.
Was brought by pioneers to Nebraska in the late 1800s by covered wagon.
From the point of view of just sensational flavor, Could you give us some things to look for that we may find in our local farmers market?
Yes, sadly, at least at this moment in time, there are about only a dozen or so heirlooms that are widely available, and we both know that's not enough to keep our taste buds lively. But a couple of my favorites that are readily available in farmers markets, the black cherry tomato. It's maroon outside, wine red on the inside, bred by the late Vincent Sapp of Tomato Growers Supply, and it's like plumstone fruit. The green zebra tomato, bred by Tom Wagner, also known as Tommy Tomato Seed.
Mm-hmm.
His creations are dazzling. It amazes me to think he created this tomato when he was only a 10-year-old kid, or he started when he was 10. These are the olive yellow tomatoes with deep green zebra stripes that you see in the market, and they're very zingy and zippy in flavor. Another one you see often is the orange banana. It's a Russian sort. It's a deep orange plum, and it's so fruity, it'll make you swoon. Tastes like apricots.
Huh.
I could go on and on. There's the red brandywine, which is blood red, and in my mind, perfection when it comes to flavor. This, in fact, is the original brandywine that was introduced in 1889. The pink-fruited brandywine we all know and love, the
right.
Suddeth's brandywine, is not the original, but that's a good one, too.
I realize, as a consumer, I buy these tomatoes because of their taste. But you see this through different eyes. What's the import as a gardener, as someone who is involved in conservation, essentially, of these tomatoes?
Well, my mission in life is to preserve agricultural biodiversity. And a lot of, we're in the middle of a mass extinction event in agriculture. At the very moment in time when we most need the genes contained in these varieties, tomatoes and other garden crops, we need them to help us prepare for drought, global climate change, pests and diseases that may evolve. And what we may need tomorrow may be lost today. And These varieties are disappearing at the rate of 1 or 2% a year. So I think that seeds belong in the hands of farmers and gardeners. And I hope that people will be inspired to take up the cause and grow their own.
Oh, here, here. Hey, Amy, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Gardener and seed conservator Amy Goldman is author of The Heirloom Tomato from Garden to Table. Now, for an easy way to show off your heirlooms, try her recipe for tomato chips. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. I've wondered if some folks are taking the idea of knowing where your food comes from a tad too far. As in raising livestock in the city, as in chickens in a Manhattan apartment. Evidently, cutting food miles down to food inches wasn't behind New Yorker Christine Patel's having chickens in her apartment. She had other reasons. Christine's on the phone. Christine, welcome.
Oh, my pleasure.
So tell me, how did you come to chickens in a New York City apartment?
Well, I never intended to raise chickens on the 11th floor of a Manhattan apartment. It started as a rescue mission. We were out on the weekend in the country. My daughter found a baby chick slumped in the corner of a friend's coop, rejected by its mother. When it was time to go home, we naturally had to take that patient back to Manhattan, but that chick lasted only a few days.
Oh.
Clearly something was very wrong, as our friend Tiziana had warned, but still we were devastated. But then, a few weeks later, the phone rang. "You may not thank me for this," were the first words that Tiziana said, but she had driven down from the Berkshires with two baby chicks tucked under her shirt for Isabella. So we set them in a cardboard box under a heat lamp in her room and filled a watering jar, scattered some scratch, otherwise known as chicken feed, and hovered. And these were two little black silkies, Tiziana thought, and that was the beginning, a breed that Marco Polo actually had encountered.
Oh, really?
In the Far East.
Really?
Yes. So soon they were skittering through the scratch and boldly pecking at the cardboard walls of the box. And that's when I realized that chickens can fly, because I would come home and I would find chirps sitting sort of on the top of the box, surveying the house. And then I would go get a bigger box at the grocery store, and once again, they would both be sitting on the top of the brim. And the day I found them sitting on the sofa, I realized we really needed to get a coop.
How big is your apartment? Just
Oh, I'd say about 1,000 square feet. I mean, when you think chicken coop, Manhattan Co-op, they're basically the same.
I
mean,
understand.
At one point, I really felt, listen, let's just stretch some chicken wire over the front door and call the whole thing a coop. That would be it. But we built this coop in the middle of Isabella's bedroom. We got some branches from Central Park. Those were the roosts. Cheep and Chirp, our two chickens, would sleep together every night, right standing beside each other.
Now, wait a minute. Did they live in the coop the entire time? Because I'm thinking if you let these little birds wander the apartment, wouldn't there be a horrific mess?
Well, I'm going to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
Yes, there is. But we are a committed family. We eat organic, and of course we had to have free-range chickens. When Isabella came home from school, she would let them out. And this is another thing that I find very astonishing. People think of chickens as not particularly intelligent.
Right.
But whoever coined that term dumb cluck never met Cheep and Chirp. As soon as I opened the refrigerator door, they would come running. They knew that food was to be had soon. And so my problem was I quickly ran out of chicken feed, which is not easy to find in Manhattan. It doesn't exist.
I'd imagine, yeah.
No egg whey. So I went to the health food store and bought all sorts of grains, millet and quinoa and barley and wheat and everything, mixed it up. And then they loved tomatoes, fresh kale, Swiss chard, romaine lettuce. They would grab it with their beak, toss it into the air, and then tussle it to the ground. And then cantaloupe, they devoured that down to the rind. But my true salvation was corn on the cob, because it turned out that we actually had a crowing hen. One of them, early in the morning, would crow when they woke up. And the only way I could shush them was to grab a cob from the refrigerator and throw it into the coop, and then they were content. We could all sleep for another hour.
Did they ever lay eggs?
Oh, of course. One day, Isabella called me. I was at my office, and I happened to be in a meeting, so I got the full panoply of messages later. The first messages were, Mom, there's something wrong with Cheep. She's sitting in a corner. She won't come out. She's making all this noise. I can't get her to stop. Then on the second call, it sounded like Isabella was holding back tears. She said, Mom, she's really in pain. Come home. I think she may be dying. And then on the third call, she said, Mom, I can now confirm that Cheep is a girl. So she had laid her first egg on the stack of New York Times. But then the next week, Chirp laid an egg. And frankly, we had enough eventually that we could have opened a stall at the Green Market.
So do you still have the chickens?
No. Finally, Cheep got, she had always been bossy, but suddenly she wasn't sociable. She would run into a corner by the stereo cabinet and just sit there, and she refused to come out. It was very unusual behavior. And she wasn't eating, she wasn't drinking, she was losing feathers. We realized there was an egg underneath her when I did entice her out with a bit of cantaloupe at one point. But what was really happening is she was broody. She wanted to hatch her eggs. And I had a conversation with Isabella, and I said, you know, it's really time that these two chicks had a mate, and they should have babies of their own and a family.
So they went back to the farm.
They went back to the Berkshires, and we actually went to visit them. And as soon as they saw Isabella, they both came running out of the scrimmage of other chicks. It was a great visit.
Christine, that's quite a story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Writer Christine Padel lives in New York City with her daughter and husband, and at the moment, no chickens. Well, I couldn't resist a supper egg recipe. Whether they come from your very own birds or someone else's, try our recipe for pan-crisped deviled eggs, fresh from the pages of our new book, How to Eat Supper. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Look, growing your own food in a little city garden is nothing new. Our ancestors were doing it forever. But creating the barnyard version of the Peaceable Kingdom in the middle of Seattle could be a tad tricky. But when you've got a dream, you gotta go with it, as reporter Josh McNichols finds out.
Jenny Grant lives in Seattle, not too far from Lake Washington. She loves living in the city. It's loud, but there are good schools and lots of culture.
If I wanted, I could milk the goats and then go to the opera. I haven't done that, but I know I could.
Besides, all her friends live here.
I would be lonely in the country.
But when she wants ice cream, Jenny doesn't go to the grocery store. She goes to her backyard. That's where you'll find Jenny's little farm. She keeps her animals in a little pen beyond her kitchen garden. But keeping a farm on a small urban lot is complicated.
So I got home about noon, and my neighbor, who's in her 80s, across the street, opened her window and leaned out, and she said, "Oh, Jenny, your goats were in my yard today." And I said, "Which one?" And she said, "Well, all of them." Then I checked my voicemail, and I had all these messages from different neighbors. "Oh, Jenny, your goats are walking down the street." Fortunately, they didn't eat anything too valuable or jump on any expensive cars. I was very lucky.
For Jenny, it's all worthwhile. To show me why, she invites me over to make blackberry ice cream. She swears she can do it without buying anything. Jenny's ice cream recipe calls for cream, milk, eggs, honey, and blackberries. So Jenny heads out to the goat shed.
Okay, Snowflake, you come.
After heating the milk on the stove, she's ready to put it through the cream separator. It's a primitive-looking appliance. There's no on-off switch. You just plug it in and try to keep it from vibrating off the counter.
Sounds like an airplane taking off.
All right, well, it's going pretty fast in there. All right.
But 30 minutes later, there's still no cream. Jenny calls in her 8-year-old mechanical genius, Spencer.
Where's the rest of the pieces? Here's the phone that we forgot last time. And it squirted milk all the way out of there. It was really cool.
But eventually, the machine reluctantly squeezes out 2 cups of cream. Next, Jenny collects 4 eggs. She drops them in a blender with the cream.
Okay, so we're going to add our eggs. This is Henrietta's egg. You can tell because it's dark brown and speckled. So those girls all did an excellent job. Those look like beautiful eggs.
She adds a little more goat milk.
Okay. And now honey.
Jenny collects honey from a hive just outside her goat pen. She's got about 5 gallons of it stored in a bucket in her house.
Let me show you this. Now smell this. This is honey from the hive. Doesn't this the box smell good?
Wow. In fact, it's probably blackberry honey. They grow wild all around this neighborhood. So we head out to pick the last ingredient for our ice cream.
So you see, there's a woman picking berries. But see, those berries have been all picked over. See, we're going to go behind that. But we have to get in the water, but still we need a lot more berries.
Some of these are the fattest blackberries I've ever seen.
The blackberries join the rest of the ingredients in the blender.
Now this is the 2-horsepower blender.
Be quiet, Mommy! It's
very loud! All right. Oops.
Jenny cools the mix in her fridge, then dumps it into the ice cream maker.
I think that's good.
Catch her sneaking a little cinnamon into the mix. It's the only ingredient that doesn't come from her backyard. But life's full of compromises, right?
If we were going to be real purists, we would have gone to some frozen lake in the winter and carved ice and saved it till this point. But we cheated. We just put the cylinder in the freezer.
Despite those compromises, it's just about the best ice cream I've ever had.
Nice and creamy. And it's plenty sweet.
But Spencer hardly touches his ice cream. Instead, he's gnawing on a piece of plain white bread.
Usually I make him eat whole wheat bread, so...
Oh, so the white bread's a real treat.
A real treat. Poor child is deprived.
The piece was produced by Seattle-based Joshua McNichols. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what's the connection between mummies and wax paper? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the connection between mummies and wax paper? Well, the answer is cinnamon, possibly as a new earth-friendly way to preserve foods. New is in quotes here because the Egyptians used cinnamon to preserve mummies. It stopped mold from happening. Well, science has been a bit slow on the uptake, as in 5,000 years, but cinnamon's anti-molding properties are being tested with wax paper. In Spain, scientists took bread tainted with mold, wrapped it in wax paper that contained cinnamon oil, and the mold's growth was slowed by 96%. Besides, the bread stayed fresh for almost 10 days. Now, if you put cinnamon in the bread, it doesn't do the same thing. The next test is to see if the cinnamon wax paper works on produce, which might give us a cinnamon-scented green bean, which is not a bad thing.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is on the line. We have Terry calling from Birmingham, Michigan. Hey, Terry, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi,
well,
what's up?
Over the 4th of July weekend, I was driving. I had a 10-hour drive, so there and back I listened to probably about 6 months of podcasts because I'm usually at church when your show is on. And I got so
inspired. Sounds like, I don't know if I would do that.
Oh, it was a blast. Anyway, so I got inspired to do all these things, and one of them was with a variety of your guests who had different kinds of mousses and pâtés. I thought for my next dinner party, what a great idea, just to have a mousse for every course or a pâté for every course. But I have vegan friends, and so if I was thinking, you know, of that wonderful, when you use the Italian, what, cannelli beans? And
cannellini.
Cannellini. Anyway, and carrots and garlic and bay leaf, and they just get creamy and wonderful. And
yeah, they'd be fabulous.
That might be a really neat pâté, but if you're a vegan, what do you use to make it set? Otherwise, it'll be just like a hummus, and I don't want that.
Well, you know, the thing you're talking about, you want to make a bean pate that you can slice.
Yes.
Okay. It is tricky because some people use gelatin. And by the way, there is vegan gelatin.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, one of the tricks is, you know, you cook the beans or you take even canned beans and you can marinate them to give them great flavor any way you want. And as you said, you know, putting in those vegetables would be fabulous. But what you want to do, don't add a lot of liquid to them, obviously. But then you can add some, you know, a vegetable broth that you could even have put wine in. You could put spices in it, whatever, that you gel with a vegan gelatin. It usually comes from seaweed.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of health food stores and co-ops and whatever will carry it.
Okay.
So that's not hard to do. But, you know, another thing you can do, and again, this is going to vary. Some beans have more moisture than others. But you could press it, I would bet.
Oh.
And don't puree the beans. Maybe puree a little bit of them, but leave the rest whole. And if you take a little loaf pan or whatever you want to do it with, line it with plastic wrap. Do your layers. You know, you could have a layer of vegetables and, you know, a layer of the beans. You could have black beans and red beans. You know, you could do all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Make sure they're cooked really well. You want them to be just the smidge side of mushy. And then what I would do is press it.
Cool.
So you put some more plastic wrap on top of it, and you take a, well, if you have a brick lying around, you may not have a brick.
I have a brick.
No. But you know, anything that is the shape of the interior of that pan, so you can press the you-know-what out of it. And that should do the trick. If for some reason it starts to fall apart, when you slice it to put it on the plate, I would swirl it. And I would put a beautiful, oh, I don't know, wedge of lemon or a little lemon peel in the center, and they'll all think it was meant to be that way.
Okay. That sounds wonderful. Well, thanks so much for answering my question.
Hey, you're welcome. Take care, Terry.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. We have got Dan calling from Memphis. Hey, Dan, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about figs.
Figs? Oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
We have a very generous, bountiful fig tree, and we have to start picking every day when they start coming in.
Oh, wow.
Very perishable, so we eat a lot of them, use them in salads and cobblers, and even grill them with prosciutto or bacon and cheeses. But I'm trying to find some other uses that don't involve canning them. I'd even like to copy. There's a commercial fig and Vidalia onion sauce.
Yeah.
I can't figure out exactly how to do that.
Have you considered freezing? Do you have space to freeze?
I have space to freeze. Just freeze them whole?
You can freeze them whole. They'll be good. They're going to get mushy, but that means you cook them into something or you serve them mushy. You puree them and, you know, they're delicious pureed. You suddenly, you know, puree them with cream and a little lemon and whatever, and you've got ice cream or, you know, du sorbet. But, yes, you can freeze them. But this is what I was wondering. Since you have such an abundance of them, you have the luxury of fooling around with them. You know, most of the time, most of us get figs and we eat them straight because we just don't get them very often.
Right.
Anything that you can do with a peach or a nectarine when it comes to a chutney, a conserve, anything like that, you can substitute fig. And you can do some really exciting things with it. Like, I mean, I'm just offhand, if you thought about make a syrup of sugar, fresh ginger, and a little bit of vinegar and simmer that and then drop your figs into that and let them cook just a little bit. And you could tuck that in the fridge and it could keep for several weeks and it would be fabulous. And they would pick up that gingery flavor. It would be wonderful. Another thing, you know, and I'm going to go way back now, a great tradition in Italy is because everybody had fig trees. They often had fig trees shading the bread oven for some reason. I think it was the warmth of the oven in the northern climates would be good for the tree. But they would dry the figs. They'd split the figs, and they would put them on screens in the sun, okay? And they might sprinkle a few anise seeds on them, and they would dry them almost all the way. Now, you could do that in an oven if you have a concern, if it's very moist where you live, because you don't want mold.
Right.
But you dry them. And then what they would do, so you have two halves of the fig. They would already have the little bit of crushed anise seed rubbed into it. They would put something like an almond and a bay leaf, a fresh bay leaf. And they'd reassemble the fig and they'd pack them very tightly into a pan so they were all upright with those bay leaves, you know, which have a wonderful scent and aroma. And then they'd bake them very slowly at about 275 degrees for an hour or two. And they would package those and make gifts of them.
Yum.
And they would keep for a bit of time. The key is getting them dry to begin with, but they're fabulous.
Okay.
And also remember, you can make chutneys out of them. You know, think of maybe some cinnamon sticks and the figs and vanilla beans and, you know, a little sweet sour with that and cook that down almost to a jam-like consistency. Add a little onion even to that as a balance and then put that in a jar and stick it in the freezer. Bring it out in winter as a condiment, you know, for a roast chicken. It would be fabulous.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
I know we are insanely jealous up here in the North Country.
I'm glad.
You're evil, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252. We have got Susanna calling from Seattle. Susanna, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I want to talk about bananas. I buy them for their nutrients,
right.
And especially the potassium.
Right.
But I only like them when they're just turning ripe.
Me too.
They start
Me too. Yeah.
To get the brown spots and start to get soft, I don't like them.
Yeah.
And I end up putting them in my freezer to make banana bread. And one can only make so much banana bread. I've tried sautéing them, like caramelizing them and eating that with like pancakes. And I've looked through many of my cookbooks and baking books and have not been able to find any other recipes to use them. And so I feel like I'm just contributing to Seattle's compost in by, you know, because I can only put so many in my freezer. So I need some help.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. I've just been in New York and I had an incredible meal at a Malaysian place called Fatty Crab. And not that I ate a banana dish, but what I did have was pork belly with watermelon pickles. But I mean, what they did was they took ripe, ripe watermelon chunks and they just did a little rice wine vinegar on them with just a little bit of, they used a Indonesian spice or a Malaysian spice called galangal.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, but you could use Chinese five spice powder.
Okay.
Which you can get now in a lot of supermarkets. It's fennel and cinnamon, I think, and clove and whatever.
I have some of that.
A little rice wine vinegar or lime juice. And don't – this is before you freeze them, but when they're still on the overripe
sure.
side, cut them into chunks and roll them in that.
Oh, that sounds very interesting.
And that could really be lovely because of the acidic backdrop against that really sweet banana. The other thing that might be a cool idea is – what would happen if you mix the five spice powder or ground up fresh ginger with sugar, rolled the chunks in that, and then grilled them?
Ooh, that sounds very good.
Now, even if they turn to mushy, they're going to be the best mushy you've ever put in your mouth, right?
I think that sounds delicious.
Doesn't that sound like fun? You could do chili and sugar. You see, you know what I'm saying? That, and then I wonder, what's a contrast to that super sweet banana would be tamarind. Tamarind, you know, tamarind
right.
concentrate.
I love tamarind.
Tamarind's fabulous because it's fruity and sour
yes,
against that.
That. Yeah.
And what if you were to take some tamarind concentrate, some of your mushy bananas, some whole milk yogurt and some honey and sugar and or sugar and, maybe a pinch of salt. What the heck? And make a smoothie.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
But semi-freeze it.
Okay.
You know, maybe even semi-freeze it and then puree it again. So you get like a slushy smoothie.
Okay.
And it would be that incredible color of tamarind. That would be very
that
cool
really
in more ways than one. That could really be fabulous.
Well, these are very interesting ideas, and I never in a million years would have come up with that. So.
Yeah, this is all because I went to a Malaysian restaurant, and my head went to that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love it. Thank you very, very
hey,
much.
Hey, thank you. You take care.
Thank you, Lynn. Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Next up is Francis calling from Nashville. Francis, what can I do for you? What
Hi,
do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you?
I am good.
We have a bumper crop of bok choy in our garden, and my husband and I were wondering, is there anything else you can make with it besides Thai food?
Oh, yeah.
Now, keep in mind, we're vegetarian, although we do eat dairy, although my husband doesn't really like dairy, but he will eat it if I force him to. So,
well, first of all, just if you have little ones, do you have little ones?
Oh, yes, we have the small bok choy.
Okay, if you just toss that, you can do this a couple of ways. The idea is you toss it with a bit of flavorful oil. So it could be Asian sesame oil. It could be Mediterranean olive oil. All right? Mm-hmm. Maybe some diced onion, salt and pepper. Coarse salt is great. And slow grill them on your grill.
Oh, really?
They're fabulous. And you can do them until they're crunchy. You can do them until they're totally wilted. And you can do salt, pepper. You could do that oil with some herbs mixed in with it. But I like better to just do olive oil or the sesame oil, the salt and pepper. And then, if I'm doing sesame oil, I usually throw some soy sauce in there.
Okay.
But the idea is then I put fresh herbs on it when it comes off the grill.
Like what?
Oh, you could do, if you did the olive oil, you could do fresh thyme and a squeeze of lemon. And then the other thing that you could do is think about using them raw, especially the smaller ones, but make a wonderful rice salad, maybe with fresh fruit and, you know, some fresh herbs like mint and fresh basil with chopped up, you know, cherries or peaches.
Ooh.
And cook up rice. You could make it yellow rice with turmeric and toss it with a dressing of maybe fresh lime juice and a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, maybe a tad of garlic, and make it sweet and savory.
Ooh.
Wouldn't that be nice? You could do watermelon or cantaloupe and fresh basil. It would be fabulous. And do it in small chunks, you know, do the fruit in small chunks. And then you could either steam or just use the leaves raw. Mm-hmm. But you could stuff them so that you actually reassemble the little bok choy. But hidden inside is this colorful, delicious salad. And then you could sprinkle it with some oil and vinegar, too. Put it on a plate and you slice into it and you get the rice and the fruit and the crunch of the bok choy. It would really be fabulous and wonderful on a hot summer night.
Great. I think I'm going to do it right now then.
I think I am, too, now that I'm talking about it. So does that help, Frances?
Yes, it helps an awful lot. I had not thought of doing any of those things. So thank you so much.
Oh, you are welcome. And enjoy the bumper crop. It sounds great.
All right. Thanks.
Hey, you take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this quote from Dr. Bodler. He said, "Doubtless God could have made a better berry, but doubtless God never did." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, information on everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Have a visit. You'll find podcasts, newsletters, a recipe archive from our very talented guests, and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.